Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food here on July 22nd, 2014. It's a nice hot day here in New York. Really nice. I'm really starting to appreciate the heat. I know some people can't handle the heat, and I've been in that situation from time to time, but I'm handling the heat a lot better these days, and I'm happy about that. There's something very cleansing, I think, when we're in the heat. I like to sit on my terrace in the morning and just sweat. It feels great. It feels really cleansing, and I like to think it's good for you. As long as you keep hydrating, right? We have to keep hydrating. Keep that water in because we're losing a lot. So if you're thinking you're not feeling exactly right, have a drink of water. A drink of clean water. In fact, I could use a little right now, and I don't have any. Practice what you preach, Karen. Okay. Well, let's bring on my first guest. We've got a few guests on the show today. It's going to be a very interesting and varied program. I'm looking forward to it. My first guest is Ann Dinshaw, and she has a new book, Powerful Vegan Messages. She co-authored the book with her late father, American Vegan Society founder H.J. Dinshaw. Now, Jay spearheaded the modern vegan movement in America, influencing many people with his message of dynamic harmlessness. Today, Ann brings the message to a new generation with a gentle, entertaining way of communicating in her own style. She's also the author of Dating Vegans. We had her on the show to talk about that book a while ago. Hi, Ann. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Hi, Karen. I had a drink of water right before we started our conversation.
You're smarter than me. I've got a head of kale here I could chomp on, but I forgot to bring water into the studio. But I think I'm okay. Anyway, how are you? How's Clint? How's your mom?
Oh, I'm great. Everybody's doing well. Clint and I just played a little tennis outside in the yard before it was time to come in and talk with you.
And how old is he now?
He's 3 and a half.
You know, I don't believe that. He just looks and sounds so beyond his years.
He is, and he really does a lot with helping me write. People don't believe how much he really inspires me. He comes up with some of the most witty, amazing things that I know. Some of it is just the things that I've taught him, but he puts it in his own words, and he'll come up with things like we shouldn't eat animals because the animals deserve to have fun. The animals want to do fun things. And that's not quite the way that I phrased it to him. But he just puts it so simply that, he was a big reason why I had to work with my dad's old writings and repackage them for today, because I think people really are receptive to veganism, and they just need to hear it from some different voices.
Well, I want to say that many of us who knew your father are so grateful to him, and you can tell by some of the stories and writings in this book. You've had other people submit essays and stories about your dad, and he touched many of us, and it was a huge shock. I'll never forget it in 2000 when he passed. I'm sure it was a great shock to you and your family, but the vegan world was profoundly moved and saddened. But his work lives on, and it lives on in you, and I'm grateful for that.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's one of those things that I think we can all learn from. There were so many people that came forward with stories in the past 14 years that I don't know if they would have shared those stories with me yet if my dad were still here, unfortunately. but because somebody's gone, then people really want to remember, and they want to share how they've been touched by his life and his message. And, when enough time has passed, I felt that it was right to, bring forward his writings again and have a bit of a tribute to him. So the book also tells his biography. And along the way, we make everything applicable to today's world and bring you up to date. So it was a lot of fun. It was a lot more than I thought it would be. I thought, I'll get 10 people to write stories. Well, I had to stop when I had over 40 stories or else the book wasn't going to come out. But it's been wonderful listening to how everybody's been not just inspire to become vegan, but there's so many people who really do great advocacy work, spreading the vegan message, informing people in gentle ways. And so that's really what I wanted to get across, is the ripple effect of our actions. So it wasn't just my dad, but all these other people who are now doing such good work, and how they are regular people like you and me, and they decided that this was what they need to learn about, and they made a commitment to learning about it and came up with ways to make changes.
Now, there are, happily, I want to say this, there are many, many more organizations all over the world right now that are promoting a similar message to your organization, and then putting different spins on them. And I found that in activism, even when the message is peace and compassion, we get a lot of anger and we get a lot of judgment. And I never got that from the American Vegan Society. There was always this very loving, peaceful, calm, quiet character. I know your mom, Freya, has it, and I'm sure your dad was a part of that, and his writings definitely have it. That's very unique and very special.
Well, thank you. We like to think that we're kind of the organization, you know, with the name American Vegan Society. We want to be very inclusive of people, very welcoming of people. And as far as having other organizations promoting veganism, I think that's great. You often need to hear about things from three different sources before you believe things. And so if you hear about it from us and you hear about it from someone else, that's terrific. We want everybody to learn about veganism in whatever way they can. And back when my dad was beginning to promote it in this country, there really wasn't anyone going around telling about veganism. And he was considered a crank. And so he said, well, hey, you need a crank to get things started. And so he was okay with that. I'm really the girl next door. I wouldn't have been comfortable being a crank. I just enjoy, you know, hanging out with my friends and being a normal citizen. And oh yeah, I happen to be vegan, so you want to come over for dinner. So I give a lot of really simple ways that people can do different things. So I encourage people to get out there and, you know, do three things. If you're already vegan, do three things to encourage other people. And if you're not vegan, but you're just curious about it, then learn about it in three different ways. So whether you're reading a book or going to an event or listening to a show or whatever it is, get three really good sources of information.
What is dynamic harmlessness? It sounds really
great
good.
Great question. Great question. I'm so glad you asked.
Yeah.
Dynamic harmlessness was the way that my dad explained ahimsa. Ahimsa was a Sanskrit word that means non-harming, but he felt that really doesn't say enough, because you need to go out and do the least harm and the most good with your actions. So if you sit in a cave and do absolutely nothing, you might be practicing ahimsa, but you're not really benefiting the world. So my dad was very inspired by people like Gandhi, who really advocated to go out and do some good in the world. So quickly, in a nutshell, dynamic harmlessness is the phrase my dad promoted that means to do the least harm and the most good.
Now, in the book, you had this fun thing in the beginning and in the end where you let us listen in. It was written, of course, but it felt like we were there, to a conversation you were having with the Robbins family, the Campbell family, the Esselstyn family. And your four families are really the new dynasty of the plant-based movement, and it's so lovely to see it continuing through the generations. Did this event really happen?
Well, it's based on actual interviews. I wish we all had time to come together and do things like this.
I wanted to be there at that party.
Oh, that's the point. I want the readers to be there, and I want you to feel like you're there. But it is actual interviews, actual conversations, and we all had a great time writing it together. And so what we really wanted to get across is that it does take so many different voices promoting a common message. And our common message is you don't have to eat animals. You can eat plants. And it's better for your health. It's better for the environment. It's better for the animals. And so the three families all have very different ways of presenting pretty similar material. We're not going to agree on every tiny thing, but that's okay. The fact that we can all, you know, sit in a virtual room together and enjoy a great dinner and talk about how we need to continue to encourage and support each other. That was the thing we were trying to accomplish. And for me, that was the part that was very important, because I really wrestle with my role of how to continue what my parents have started. And these people just made it very crystal clear to me what we need to be doing. And to hang out with them and get to know them was just a truly wonderful experience.
Sorry about that. I just got unplugged. And now I'm plugged again. What I wanted to talk a little bit more about is common ground. So you were talking about how you didn't have to agree with everybody on with the Robins and the Campbells and the Esselstyn, but you do agree on many, many things. And that's where we need to focus, even with people who completely disagree with what we think. And I'm going to be getting into that a little bit in the next part of the program. But common ground is really important, because I do believe that all of us want the same things: clean air, clean water, nutritious food for our families. And we need to focus on those things and then find ways to optimize those simple things that we want and need.
Well, Powerful Vegan Messages definitely encourages people to find common ground. You know, find something that you like doing with someone else before you try to share with them a vegan meal. And so we try to give a lot of ideas from all different people of how you can gently do some vegan advocacy, and you're not going to win anybody over by hitting them over the head with a book. You're going to win them over by, you know, talking with them a little bit.
And delicious
there's so many
food.
People who are, yes, delicious food. It is all about food, right?
Exactly.
But just talking with them a little bit and sharing with them the things that work for you. And so that's part of why, you know, my voice comes through a little bit, because my dad wasn't so much the one who would have a dinner party. He would put on a conference and have hundreds of people and, you know, share dinners with them that way. But I'm more the type that's going to reach out to my friends and throw a dinner party. And that's something that people respond really warmly to, especially if I ask them ahead of time what their favorite foods are. And I try to make it something that they would definitely enjoy and not be fearful of if I'm the only vegan they know.
Well, the thing that was really important about the American Vegan Society back in the 60s when it was founded, there was no internet. And what was amazing reading about it, and I know I experienced myself, was that those of us who were coming to this realization about where our food came from and where we wanted our food to come from and what we didn't want to happen, we found each other. We found all of the like-minded people, not only in this country, but around the world. And your father was so important in making that happen. And it's so easy to feel alone. And, you know, sometimes when you have ideas that nobody else is thinking about, you question, you know, am I crazy? And then you find other people who feel the same way. And there's that strength in numbers. And your father was so important in making that happen pre-internet. It just blows my mind how we did anything before the internet, before smartphones.
Yeah, he really, that was the part that I didn't know so much about him. I knew about his writings. I had seen the books. I had gone and visited with him, you know, when he's traveled around doing lecture tours. I've visited places and heard him speak. And so I knew about that aspect of his life and his work. But what I really didn't know is how much he reached much he encouraged people, amazing people who shared their stories, like Victoria Moran, who said that he just never gave up on her. And, you know, now look at the amazing things and the amazing books that she does.
Exactly,
and
those seeds.
Vegan Academy. And if my dad would have given up on someone like that, you know, she might not be accomplishing the things that she does today. And I was just amazed how many people came forward with those kind of stories, that that was really the most important thing that he did, was that he was always very welcoming to people wherever they were along the vegan journey. If they were vegan yet or not, it didn't matter. As long as they were interested, he was interested in them.
Now, another thing about the American Vegan Society is you're clearly not profit motivated. And I'm a life member, and I'm happily a life member, and I only became a life member because it was affordable. There are many life memberships that are not very affordable for regular people. And, you know, I don't know how you've managed all this time, because everything is very reasonable. You have an incredible library of, like, every book ever written on the subject.
Thank you. Yes, well, we do rely a lot on people's generous donations, and we're working on revamping our website so it's a little more user-friendly, but you can go to AmericanVegan.org and get a good idea of the type of information that we have available. And we're one of the few organizations that you can call on the phone and you'll actually get a real person frequently. I'm not going to promise all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we definitely have always had a lot of interaction with the people directly who want information.
Okay, so what's next, Dan? What's next with the American Vegan Society?
Well, next is we're launching our new campaign, Vegan Generation to the Third Power, which has sprung out of the Powerful Vegan Messages book. And I mentioned a little bit about it earlier, but the campaign is encouraging everybody, it doesn't matter what your age is, to be part of the vegan generation. And we encourage people to do three actions. So if you're curious about veganism, learn about it from three sources. And if you're already vegan, find three good ways to reach out to people, like loan them those vegan books that are on your shelf, invite them to dinner, take them food shopping, help them understand what vegan things are on the grocery shelves, and just make it easier for people. Just be a very welcoming ambassador. So we're about to launch that as our new campaign, and we're going to be, we've got all sorts of ways on our website coming up that we can make it easier for people to become involved. You don't have to do a lot if you're not the person who's going to get on stage or write a book or have a radio show. That's okay. We try to have other ways that people can get involved.
You know, taking somebody to a grocery store, a guided shopping tour, is such a great thing to do, and people don't even probably realize it. But most people, when they go into a supermarket, they go to specific places to get the food they're familiar with. When I'm in a grocery store, I don't even go down most aisles because there's absolutely nothing I want in most aisles of the grocery store. But to point out all kinds of nutritious, healthy foods that people either don't see or aren't aware of, don't know what to do with. If I spend more than 5 minutes in a grocery store, I'm always talking to somebody. I always hear a question, and I'm always ready with the answer. Most of the time, the answer is kale. But guided shopping tours are great, so I'm glad you're encouraging that.
Yeah, and they can be fun, too.
Absolutely.
I like to make games out of it. Like when I go shopping with Clint, I, you know, ask him if he can find a certain vegetable first before I can. And if I go shopping with someone who can read already, then I'll, you know, we'll pick out some product, because a lot of people need those transition foods, some of those packaged vegan products that look a little bit more like the meat or the cheese. And we'll turn around the package and we'll read to see whether it's vegan. And nowadays you can cheat on this game because so many of them are marked vegan.
Yeah.
But back in the old days, you would have to turn around the label and read through it and
right.
See who could tell first whether it was vegan or not. And so I try to make it fun and enjoyable. And even for myself, I've always been a vegan shopper. But I try to find, you know, one thing that's different. One thing that's new and exciting that I haven't tried before. And so I think I'm encouraging those vegan companies to keep making those products. And then I have an opinion that I can share with other people who are really looking for those transition foods that are vegan but might be packaged to look like something else.
And I'm glad to have you out there, and all the best with Powerful Vegan Messages and for continuing the American Vegan Society legacy. I look forward to seeing you at the next Veggie Pride Parade.
Thank you.
And take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, let's move to the second part of the program. I'm really looking forward to this. We have one very brave person here in the studio. No, we have two brave people here in the studio. My next guest is Jeff Steer. He's a senior fellow at the National Center for Public Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and heads its Risk Analysis Division. He's a frequent guest on CNBC and has addressed health policy on CNN, Fox News Channel, MSNBC, as well as network newscasts. A whole lot more. He's got a law degree from Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law, and he's the chairman of the board of the Jewish International Connection New York. And we're going to be talking about a recent happening at the USDA. Welcome to It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me, Jeff.
Great to be with you, Karen.
Yeah, so now, your organization, the National Center for Public Policy Research, is a conservative think tank, and you're here at the Progressive Radio Network.
One of the good things about it is when I do the conservative talk radio shows, I have to come in wearing a suit, so it's nice to be dressed more comfortably.
That's right, especially on a hot day like today. Okay, so, well, we appreciate you dressing appropriately.
Thank you.
So what's on your mind, Jeff?
Well, I've been watching carefully what the U.S. Department of Agriculture has been doing as part of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which, as you know, is the federal advice on nutrition, on how we ought to eat. And I think that advice ought to be Congress, who's says that the USDA and the Health Department of Health and Human Services have to develop these recommendations and revise them every 5 years like they're doing for 2015, have to do so providing good science nutrition information. It has to be based on health. And what the USDA, I believe, has been doing is been shifting that debate, shifting the recommendations or the process about those recommendations to things other than nutrition, which is what's statutorily required. And that those types of things include things like sustainability, things like fair trade coffee, things like eating less meat, or if you are going to eat meat, it should be based, it should be free range grass eating meat. So I think the issue here is, what is the basis for the USDA's recommendation? Is it nutrition, or is it some other agenda? I think you and I might agree that it should be based on nutrition. I mean, that's what Congress said. If you want to argue about whether meat is sustainable or not, or whether we ought to be drinking fair trade coffee, we can have that conversation. But the debate here and the conversation here is about whether advancing those agendas, as I believe the USDA has been doing, is consistent with the law.
Well, the USDA has an interesting situation. It almost has a conflict of interest with itself, where it's responsible for nutrition, but it's also responsible for promoting agriculture. And sometimes those are not in sync with each other, especially when it comes to the dairy industry, when we learn that saturated fats aren't healthy, and then they start giving benefits to the dairy industry to promote their cheese, and at the same time they tell us to eat less cheese. So there have been some conflicts of interest. And also, for a long time, the people that have been on the Dietary Guidelines Committee have come from the meat industry, sugar industry, the dairy industry. And so those people are bringing their agenda to the table and not necessarily the best in science.
So, Karen, you gave me an example of how the USDA may not be using the best science to advance nutrition. I'll give you an example from my perspective, which I think many of your listeners may disagree with, but I think it may help you understand kind of where I'm coming from on this particular issue. And one of the conflicts of interest that I believe the USDA has is because part of its mission is to promote agriculture. The USDA spends a lot of tax dollar money encouraging people to eat organic food and kind of...
Not enough, in my opinion.
fair enough. But to push to move people towards eating more organic food. I believe that the public health goal, based on the science as we know it today, is to encourage people to eat more fruits and vegetables. And all of the science we have so far suggests that people who eat more fruits and vegetables tend to live longer lives. The data that I'm basing that on is based on 30, 40, 50
sure.
years. And that's when people were shopping in their supermarkets, not at Whole Food markets. This is based on traditional agriculture.
Sure, but prior to World War II, we didn't need organic food because we didn't use pesticides and herbicides.
Well, I think you'll find that the foods that we've been eating for the last 50 years, the people who eat more fruits and vegetables live longer and healthier lives. So I think if we
yes.
could agree, you mentioned earlier
okay,
common ground,
mm-hmm.
people eat more fruits and vegetables, and we could have the discussions about the latest organic industry-funded study that said organic food is healthier. We could have those conversations, but I think we could agree that people who eat more fruits and vegetables, generally speaking, not just organic, tend to live longer and healthier lives. That is kind of a common ground in nutrition advice. Once we've got that, I know progressives don't always like to think like economists, and that leads to poor communications. But from an economic perspective, the public health goal is to get people to eat more fruits and vegetables. People will eat more fruits and vegetables if those products come at a lower, not a higher price. Organic food across the board, maybe you could cite an exception, tends to be higher priced. So if that's the case, if conventionally grown produce is less expensive and people eat more of foods that are less expensive, we talk about how chips are cheap and vegetables are expensive, my goal from a public health perspective, as someone who thinks like an economist and has an understanding of agriculture, is across the board, we should be encouraging people to eat more fruits and vegetables. The most effective way to do that is to encourage them to eat the fruits and vegetables that are less expensive. And the USDA, by advancing an organic agenda, is actually working at cross purposes with the public health goal of getting people to eat more fruits and vegetables.
So Angela Tagto was appointed recently to work on a committee with the USDA, and you were against her appointment. I think she would agree that we want our country to eat more fruits and vegetables. But a couple of things.
Well, I'll disagree with you there, actually. What she would want, and she wasn't appointed to a USDA committee, she was actually appointed to be the executive director of the division at the USDA, whose job it is to implement the dietary guidelines. And there's
okay.
been this kind of debate over where are the dietary guidelines going. There's an advisory committee that just had its fourth set of meetings last week, and there's been a lot of talk about sustainability and some of those issues about how we ought to eat to affect climate change as part of that. I and others have criticized the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, which is not the policymaking group, but they issue recommendations. I've criticized them for focusing on sustainability rather than nutrition. The USDA responded to that criticism and says that criticism is premature because we haven't written policy yet. But now the USDA is essentially doubling down by appointing Angela Tagto to the position at the USDA executive director of the department, whose job it is to implement those new dietary guidelines. And her background is quite clear. She is this is her own definition, an environmental nutritionist.
Okay, the last time I looked at where our food came from, it came from plants that grow in the soil, take in the carbon dioxide that is put out into the atmosphere. They give off oxygen, and those plants are either fed directly to people as food or they're fed to animals, and then people eat the animals. That's plants growing in our environment. And our current method of industrial plant agriculture is devastating on our environment. We've got soil degradation. We're losing topsoil. Industrial agriculture would not take place if we didn't have petrochemical-based fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. This is not an infinite resource. We know what's related to petrochemicals. It's a limited resource. It's going to become more expensive, and it's devastating to the environment because of the greenhouse gases that they ultimately put out into the atmosphere. So using agriculture that's based on petrochemicals is not sustainable. Now, what we need to be doing is nourishing our soil, and the only way to really do that is with a nature-based organic production of plants that is not based on petrochemicals. It's based on planting plants that help each other, don't fight against each other, not this extensive monocropping and growing primarily foods to feed animals to feed people, which is really, really inefficient. So if we would focus, and I don't think the USDA is really putting a lot of money into promoting organic agriculture. They're promoting more meat and dairy and sugar and all the things that aren't really healthy for us today. I would love to see them promoting more organic agriculture. But it's quite simple that if we would focus more on plant foods and if we get into economics of it, right now our industrial agriculture really supports a very small amount of people growing what they consider efficient, and I'm using air quotes when I say efficient, because they're growing a lot of the same foods, a lot of it to feed animals, to feed people, which isn't efficient. And they're doing it with a lot of high-tech equipment, although that's wonderful. But it's not sustainable, and we won't be able to grow food, nutritious or otherwise, if we continue in this method.
So I've got what may be a surprise to you.
Oh, okay, surprise.
I'm actually an environmentalist, and I love hiking.
Are you a vegan? Are you a vegan?
I love eating vegetables.
No, but are you a vegan?
I've got a Vitamix.
Are you a vegan? Say yes or no. The answer is yes or no. You're a lawyer.
I love red meat, but
okay, so you're not a vegan.
No, absolutely not.
Okay, so I think anybody that says they're an environmentalist, if they're not a vegan, they're not really an environmentalist. But you continue.
Right. So we have kind of different views. There's this kind of at the crux of your argument.
Yes.
Is this two ways of looking at the world, and it goes back for many years, and that is we're running out of resources and we ought to kind of just hunker down. There are probably too many people that are eating too much food. Or there's kind of this more, I think, an optimistic view of abundance. One of my mentors was a man named Dr. Norman Borlaug. Dr. Borlaug won the Nobel Peace Prize for developing the Green Revolution. And I would imagine that people like Dr. Borlaug, in your view, are people who destroyed the earth, who caused more people to eat more food, which is bad because it's bad for the earth. My view is that we live in a world with more and more people. The world is not getting any bigger. The one resource that is not growing is the size of the earth. Question is, how do we use that earth most efficiently to provide for people? And before Dr. Borlaug passed away, he encouraged me, I'll always remember this, is to continue fighting for the safe and efficient use of technology that will improve the human condition. And that's what I do every day. And we may have different approaches to how to feed people. I could understand why, and I heard your arguments, why it might sound like a good idea to just have everybody eating natural foods that grow out in nature and we'll just pick them without disturbing the earth. And that sounds good. But in the world we live in today, where the population is only going to grow, unless you're going to kind of establish some population controls, I think we ought to make the best use of the resources we have to grow what I believe sustainable food to give people the nutrition that they need. And I got to say, in ways that they enjoy, which can appropriately, a lot of cultures use meat in their diets. And I think that's appropriate. I think, you know, I'm a fan of Temple Grandin. I think we ought to use, we ought to farm efficiently, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think we ought to farm efficiently. I think we ought to farm humanely. But I don't think it is necessary to cut out food.
Well, there's a couple of things when you're talking about farming efficiently. And one is, who's benefiting from that efficiency? And we see more and more small family farmers going out of business because they can't compete with the giant agribusiness. And there are a lot of places that call themselves family farms, and they're not family farms. They're big businesses. And I believe we need to get away from the big businesses. The efficiency is not really efficient. It's efficient for a small few to make a lot of money. And, you know, sometimes we have to put efficiency aside. If we can improve the economy by putting more people to work and more people actually farming, looking at their food, looking at their produce, knowing when there are bugs around that they can actually take care of without pouring tons of toxic herbicides and pesticides into the ground. It's not.
I gotta disagree
people are
with you.
Doing it and doing it well and yielding well. And if we weren't eating so much meat, we'd have a lot of land left over to be maybe less efficient. But if we could also put our technology towards making organic plant production more efficient.
Karen, it's called integrated pest management.
Yeah. Well,
and
I'm not
in favor of recklessly pouring chemicals onto the earth to kill everything.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in integrated pest management, which includes the safe use of pesticides.
Well, I don't know
when
if
necessary.
There is a safe use, but
I'm just trying to draw attention to some of the rhetoric that's used to talk about pouring killer chemicals on food, when in fact, what I think responsible farmers who are trying to get the most out of their land efficiently to supply healthy foods to their customers, and so that those farms, whether they're family farms or part of some big business, I think all of those farms ought to be sustainably efficient by using technology appropriately.
I love technology, but I don't like damaging the planet, and I really think that's the direction we're going in. And it's really dangerous because it's polluting our air, polluting our water, and causing climate change. And we need some dramatic action. And I'm actually glad that they're considering the environment when they're considering nutrition, because the two go hand in hand.
Is it possible, in your almost hypothetical worldview, to actually have food that's unhealthy, that's good for the environment, or conversely, to have healthy food that's bad for the environment?
Well, I think that organic plant production is really an ideal situation, because it puts out negligible greenhouse gases. Even conventional plant production causes a certain amount of greenhouse gases because of the petrochemicals that it uses. And I believe that we can have a balance in our environment. And, of course, it's to be seen. But if we're working towards organic plants, I think we could be really gentle on the environment.
We're going to have to cut down a lot of trees to do that.
Okay, we don't have much. I mean, we've really gone over time, and we really need to stop. But I don't agree with that at all. We have plowed so many trees today in order to allow for grazing, allow for growing food to feed animals, to feed people. We would need to grow a lot less food if we were growing it to just feed people. That's where the animals, other than the fact that I believe in thou shalt not kill, and we shouldn't be killing animals, and certainly not intensifying by putting them in these factory farms. But we would have a lot more land for wildlife preservation, for growing organic food, if we weren't growing food to feed animals, to feed people. It's very simple. So, Jeff, we need to continue this conversation, because I've got another guest coming on.
That was fun. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming, and thanks for being so brave.
My pleasure. Likewise.
Okay. Ciao. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with Friedrich Mühlen, and we're going to talk about what's going on in Germany with factory farm investigations. Hey, everybody, we're back. I'm just laughing listening to the last commercial, organic gluten-free satire. I like that. I'm laughing. All right, we're also organic here at It's All About Food. And I want to bring on my last guest. I'm very happy that we were able to connect with Friedrich Mühlen. He's been documenting factory farms for almost 20 years. His main field of action are investigations and data research into the animal industry. In the course of his work, he published countless investigations in all the major media in Germany. His most prominent and well-known accomplishment so far is the 2003 investigation into Covent's Life Science in Münster, Germany, where he worked as an animal technician for 4.5 months. He's been working as a campaigner against foie gras and live plucking for almost a decade before he founded his own organization in early 2013, Soko Tierschutz, which has been gaining major media attention and support from people due to successful campaigns, mink oil campaign, foie gras campaign, and groundbreaking investigations. Welcome, Friedrich, to It's All About Food.
Hello.
Hello, Friedrich. I'm so happy that we were able to connect.
Yeah, I'm too. The connection sometimes is a little bit weak, but let's try our best.
Let's try. You are very brave.
Thank you.
Yes, so you've done factory farm investigations. Tell me, what was it like working as an animal technician for Covent's Life Science?
Yeah, this was unfortunately, I think, a unique experience because no laboratory ever in will let me in into this place. But it was shocking, but fascinating too, how these people work in this absolutely isolated work of animal testing. Sometimes felt like a religious sect where they just think of some belief that animal testing works and just are absolutely isolated from everything around.
Yeah, I don't know how you could work that way and knowing how you feel and seeing what they were doing for so long. Very brave.
It's very hard because if you see a macaque monkey being restrained on the ground and the animal is shouting and struggling and bleeding,
yeah,
pierced wounds in the arm, it's unbelievable.
So tell me, what's going on with factory farms in Germany today?
Yeah, Germany is still one of the big countries in the world regarding factory farming. We sometimes even have even bigger farms than the U.S. But there's a lot of progress because there's not only a lot of undercover investigations like from our group, but a lot of normal people are waking up, changing their kind of how they're eating, how they're living, kind of just a big of normal people, and that's a big progress.
What is a mink oil campaign?
Yeah, that was I was questioning the same when I heard the word. I was working for so many years in animal rights, and I knew what. I found out that the dead corpses from the minks are still used.
Oh,
so of course,
Friedrich,
for the oil. Yeah.
You're kind of
yeah.
coming in and out, so...
Oh, that's...
Yeah, so keep going.
Okay, from the fur farms, the oil is used for cosmetics. And we expose this, that the people that maybe never will buy a mink coat are putting this stuff into their hair. And this was a big expose that resulted in stopping the sale of mink oil in all German retailers.
I did not know that mink oil was used in cosmetics and hair products. Does it say it in the list of ingredients, or is it called something else?
It's called Mustela oil, for example, from the Latin name of the mink.
Mm.
And if you see Mustela oil, it sounds like a nut or
something.
Yeah. The fat from a skinned bloody mink.
Now, is this a byproduct from the fur industry?
It's a byproduct. People always say byproducts are something like waste that doesn't matter. But the money the mink industry, especially the United States, it's made with mink oil. It's relevant. And it's in hard times, where the fur industry is in hard times, this profit they make with mink oil can be really relevant for the survival.
Okay, so what did your mink oil campaign consist of?
It's pretty easy. Like the most work of Soko Tierschutz, which means Soko Animal Welfare, but actually we are an animal rights group. And we just inform the people. We look for targets that are new, for topics that are fresh, sometimes ignored by all the other animal groups. Many decades. And then we just give it to the media and we talk with. And in the most cases, like with mink oil, it's pretty quickly to solve it.
Wow. So the media is friendly to your information?
Yeah, that changed in the last years. 20 years ago, there were about 4 TV reports on animal issues a year. Now, Soko Tierschutz alone has about 40 TV reports a year in Germany. And so they are not friendly, but they are very interested. And if we give really good facts, they make good reports.
Great. And what about foie gras? I know here in the United States, we had 2 companies that were making foie gras. And we had a big anti-foie gras campaign a few years ago to change some regulations. Is foie gras made in Germany?
No, it was made many, many decades ago, but it's already banned for about 20 years, like it's banned in the most countries of the European Union. But unfortunately, we have France, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Spain, and these are the foie gras producers in the world.
So you import foie gras.
Yeah, it's a typical German thing. You're not allowed to do it in their own country, but you can just buy it from abroad. It's quite a strange behavior.
That's the human way, I think. We always look for ways around to get what we want.
Yeah, we have the problem at the moment. We have one of our longest info tables. We have nearly 30 days of info table nonstop. And all the people are harm next by. Everybody's saying.
Okay, Friedrich, I'm going to ask you to repeat everything you just said because I didn't hear it.
Yeah, obviously the German broadband, the internet is really bad.
Well, maybe it's our side, or maybe it's the weather. But just start again.
Oh, it's the internet between. Yeah, I just was saying that the most people create some kind of comfort zone in their brain, the eggs or the milk from a nice source, from a family farmer, from the butcher next door. But this is the same like with other problems. The people just make it themselves comfortable and ignore the truth.
Oh, yeah, ignoring the truth. Well, all right, so we've got mink oil, we have foie gras. Are people in Germany eating more meat or less meat these days? Germans have always been big meat eaters like Americans.
Yeah, I know this from my past because my father was a meat trader and was a really important thing in my life until I got 13 and got vegan. For the first century, the meat consumption is increasing. This is already a big landmark, and this makes the industry really panicking at the moment.
Yep. It's good. So it's not increasing. That's good.
It's decreasing.
And what is
And if I now look, yeah.
well, how did your father feel about your becoming a vegan?
He was quite open to it, surprisingly, because he really knew what's going on in the meat business. He knew about all this dirty stuff going on. And so he said, okay, if this is your decision, I will support it. And he bought me my first night vision device with 14.
Nice. Now, is the raising of animals for food here in the United States is devastating on the environment for many different reasons. We've got piles of manure that aren't treated properly. We're using a lot of water and the fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides going into the water are affecting the quality of our water. There's a lot of bad things about animal agriculture. Is it the same where you are?
I would say it's the same, not that drastic sometimes. I had been in the US and I've seen how the people, for example, deal with corpses of animals, just dumping them behind the farms or whatever. This is not that easy in Germany, especially because it's a small country compared with the US. But in the whole, it's the same. Our water is spoiled, our air is dirty because of all these gases from the farms. And yeah, we have the same problems. But fortunately, the political way of dealing with it are far more progressed than in the US, I think.
Yeah, I see that all the time, and I'm excited when I see things that are happening in Europe banning certain things that I don't believe in, and then disappointed when I see something get pushed through that shouldn't be allowed. But the European community is definitely a leader in environmental regulation and animal welfare regulation.
Yes and no. If I look at, for example, all these factory farms at the foie gras production, the black hole of animal testing where no regulations at all are ruling this dirty business. The European Union for sure has good sides, but it's at the end a lot of lobbyist groups are manipulating the politicians here and paying a lot of money that everything is getting like it got in the last years.
Okay, let's talk about animal testing. I know that the European Union passed a law, I think it was last year, where animal testing wasn't allowed anymore on cosmetics. And
The cosmetic stuff was done, yeah.
Is that happening, or are people getting around it?
Yeah, anyway, it has to be said that animal testing for cosmetics are a really, really small part of the whole animal testing industry. So it's just sometimes a tactic we see that they ban something really small just to get rid of all the protesters. And of course, companies can go to abroad out of the European Union to countries of Eastern Europe or Russia or Asia and do the business there. And it's really, really difficult to control this. In the whole European Union, there are only 5 or 10 people for controls of farms, for example. This is ridiculous.
So the big animal testing today is for drugs, pharmaceuticals.
Yes, pharmaceutical, chemical, biochemical industry. This is a big business. There are even more tests for cigarettes than for cosmetics.
So. Oh, really? Oh, goodness. I've seen some public service ads showing animals smoking to show how ridiculous it is to test smoking on animals. We know it's bad for them and us. They don't want to smoke.
Yeah, of course. They don't. Beagles don't want to smoke. Monkeys don't want to smoke. But actually, it's not the cigarette industry doing the tests. It's the pharmaceutical and the government health industry, again, that are trying to solve all the problems created by smoking. And so even if you smoke one of these alternative brands, it doesn't prevent the huge animal testing, because the huge animal testing is done by only one reason, because smoking creates cancer. And a lot of companies are looking for getting money by creating this, helping to solve the cancer problem created by smoking.
Oh, so I imagine the new e-cigarettes are probably being tested on animals.
I'm quite sure, because there are a lot of chemical substances inside. And here again, not only the cigarette industry is doing this, or the industry by the e-cigarettes, but only the government facilities, toxicity testing. Everything has to be tested if it's dangerous or not. And we have this huge REACH program in the European Union, testing all chemicals again. It's killing millions of animals.
All right, let's lighten up in the last few minutes and tell me about the wonderful foods you have in Germany that are vegan and the vegan products that are coming out, clothing and shoes. What have you got going on there?
Yeah, I'm really proud, honestly, on Germany in this aspect, because we have some of the world leaders of vegan meat substitutes. We just had a big action on a festival promoting vegan barbecue stuff, and it was so amazing that meat eaters came there and said, oh, that's fantastic, and some of the people converted. I don't want to use this word, but this is... immediately and saying, I don't want to eat meat anymore if the substitutes are so tasty. And the same is happening with yogurt. We have a really good new cheese now. And this makes the biggest breakthrough, because we're winning this conflict, of course, with the media, with exposes, but at the end we're winning this conflict on the table.
Is there a vegan white sausage?
There's a vegan white sausage, and actually it's quite good. I still can remember from my childhood how these Bavarian typical sausages taste. And so there's one. And the great thing is that veganism is now a really, really great issue in Germany. If you go to a bookstore, the first thing you see is a pyramid of vegan cookbooks.
Wow.
And 20 years back, this was something like a dream. I would never think that will happen.
Yeah, well, I lived in Europe in the early 90s. I lived in the south of France, and I traveled to Munich quite often. And I was appreciative of a number of things. One is you have the great reform houses where I could get my soy milk and my vegetarian products. And I found in the restaurants, it seemed easier there than in other European countries to explain to people what I wanted to eat and to eat vegan.
Yeah, sometimes you still get a really strange face from the people. But if I compare it, 20 years ago, the people didn't thought, if I say I'm vegan, they thought I have some kind of sickness or whatever.
Yeah, right.
And today they say, oh, you're vegan, we have some options available. Or the people say, oh, I'm vegan too. This is happening today. And so I'm optimistic. I think if we go on with frequently showing the truth and advertising for good alternatives, how rich vegan diet is, and what a great stuff for the nature and for your own body, then we will succeed. And even this multi-billion industry has no chance at all. I'm more optimistic than ever.
Oh, I love that. And I believe in it too. Friedrich, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. I look forward to visiting Germany and trying some white vegan sausage very soon.
You're welcome. I'm only 50 kilometers from Oktoberfest.
Oh, so, great. And vegan beer.
This is difficult because of gelatin, and it's cleared with gelatin, but
there are some
vegan alcohol too.
Yeah, there are some. Okay, thank you, and be brave. Keep continuing doing what you're doing. I love it.
You're welcome. Sorry for the bad connection.
Yeah, well, I understand you, and that's good. All right, tschüss. Okay, that's the end of this program. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. And don't forget my nonprofit, ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. We need your visits. We need to hear from you at info@realmeals.org. And if you haven't seen The Lone Vegan Preaching to the Fire yet, what are you waiting for? It's my 70-minute documentary, and watch it, okay? And have a delicious week.